We're going to talk about metrological traceability as a key to standardization and harmonization of vitamin D results within a lab, within a clinic, in a hospital, and within a country, between countries, and patients and staff moving from one place to the other, getting reasonable, comparable results. And this is where we are going to look at the learning objectives today. We are going to review and understand what metrology is and what is its impact on measurement of vitamin D, understand the complex and composite forms of vitamin D in the big matrix that they survive and live in, analyze the current lab methods for vitamin D and ascertain their source of standardization, discuss current recommendations of IOM or Institute of the Endocrine Society recommendations or recommendations that are coming up by every other subspecialty areas, try to comprehend vitamin D harmonization and see if we can use randomized controlled trials and clinical practice guidelines. They could be harmonized, like Dr. Laila has just said, between labs, within lab, country to country, and clinic to clinic, where we don't have problems where a patient moves with his patient electronic medical file now and having problems with the clinicians and physicians looking at that patient. Lastly, I would like to show you a slide of vitamin D measurement accuracy that Dr. Laila has just shown you, and I will just update you on the latest analysis of the DCAS survey and look at the performance measurement quality specifications that come out from the lab of Professor Linda Thienpont, who is the chair of IFCC, who is going to be looking at this issue. Lastly, we'll look at vitamin D standardization program worldwide as it exists, that has just started by the CDC in the United States, and how it is going to impact looking at population vitamin D programs and how it is going to be started for the first time ever in the lab here in the United Arab Emirates and in the lab of one of the most eminent pathologists that has just spoken. Now, looking at this slide in here, if we want to look at the adding value in laboratory, it has never been a great chance looking at the diagnostic accuracy impacting completely being dependent on the analytical accuracy. And this is a slide by the president of the IFCC, Graham Beustel, which I have taken by his permission. And number one on the science wheel stands standardization and harmonization, where we look at a given particular analyte and make sure, or we ensure, a physician or a clinician gets a reasonable amount of recoveries within that particular method and reports it to the physician, and that from lab to lab is similar to a given extent. Now, going back to the title of the lecture, metrological traceability, this is a little bit of a science that goes on. I would like to educate some of the lab staff what we're looking at. What is metrology? Metrology is a science of measurement, and measurement is what we are in the business in pathology laboratory. And report and measurement is what we give, and this is what has revolutionized what we are after and the brilliant impact chemical pathology has done on a lot of current issues that we are looking at. The number one issue where standardization has helped us in looking at is cardiovascular diseases, where lipid standardization program has helped us in identifying patients who are at a greater risk for cardiology interventions. Number two, we have looked at big standardizations in creatinine, where creatinine standardization program has helped the lab and a nephrologist in chronic diseases of renal problems where GFR has been standardized. Number three, we looked at very recent standardization issues with hemoglobin A1C, where diabetes has been standardized as a measurement test within pathology. So the business we are in here in pathology is measurement, and the science of measurement is governed by a particular science called metrology. And metrology is being looked at to ensure that the labs performing analytical testing report a result, identify an analyte, and there is comparability between labs, within countries to countries. So when people keep moving, there is not much of a difference, and the difference should be controlled within the prescribed analytical quality performances that have been just described by Dr. Laila. Now, looking at small little definitions of standardization, the term standardization is used when results for a measurement, this is a bit of a technical definition, or what we call an analyte, are equivalent. That means in addition to the results, these are traceable to an international system of SI through a higher order of primary reference material or reference measurement procedure. So this is what is the take home message, is standardization will give you a higher order of measurement, and I will come to this in my coming slides, where your assay would stand. Would it be for vitamin D, or would it be for glucose, would it be for bilirubin, or would it be for lipoprotein measurements? Which order of calibration measurement to a standard reference material you would wish your lab to be standardized, so that you stand in with the peers who are in line with the standardized method, and how this can be looked at from a lab who's participating not just within himself with the internal quality control, but how you would judge your lab when the reports come back that Dr. Laila has just shown, the DCAS report, and you can see where you stand. And the lower form is harmonization. In harmonization, it is generally used when results are equivalent, either by being traceable to a reference material or to a consensus approach. And what does this mean? We'll come to it. But this one neither has higher order of primary reference material or a reference method. So if this didn't exist, you are doing well, you're doing very, very good, but at that particular time, the evolution of the topic of the testing methodology was limited to that order of reference in a hierarchy of traceability. So now, looking at big lectures we've had this morning, looking at pregnant women, looking at a lot of infection control, diabetes, cardiovascular, a lot of great interest coming out of vitamin D. There has been another big push with the IOM report coming out saying labs should be performing tests which should be standardized. Now, coming to the definition again, this is the one that is being put out. What is metrological traceability is the property of the measurement result, which I just said, whereby the result can be related to a reference through a document unbroken chain of calibration. Now, this is something, again, what I've said is what we have gone through in the steps and gained through traceability in different areas of chronic diseases in the hospital healthcare system. Now, chief organizations that have been sponsoring this is the JCTLM, Joint Committee for Traceability in Laboratory Medicine. This is a European, North American concern which operates through Europe, and it's also sponsored by IFCC. And all of these organizations are putting in together their efforts so that most of the tests that you get in, which are being done, are standardized as much as possible. Now, like I said, in the end, after this, I will move on to vitamin D itself. So this is a summary of metrological traceability, a traceable calibration hierarchy, where my friend up in one of the companies in here was just saying, calibration trace, cal trace, cal trace. So this is something you will hear from a lot of people who come in and say, my method is good, my kit is good, I have cal trace. So what it means is calibration traceability with a reference procedure or material, and this is how his method is superior to the other ones. And the traceability chain, this is what you get, is each level of calibration hierarchy is either a measurement procedure or a measurement standard. And the measurement procedure transfers the value of the calibrator to a measurement standard of the next lower level. So you have a chain of hierarchy where each one of the reference method to a material, to a method, to a material, so you go down. And each of these steps, please listen, each of these steps, when you come down the hierarchy, defines a level of a percentile of measurement of uncertainty. That means each level when you come down to the hierarchy method, you lose a certain percentage of accuracy to the given reference method. So the full definition again would give you where your measurement of uncertainty and how much it is. Now when you're looking at this, right, looking at this here, at the highest order you would look at is defining your measurement to a primary reference material and then primary reference procedure and then calibrator and here and then you come down to the manufacturer and then the manufacturer calibrators and then the lab does it and the patient gets their value. So this is where you're looking at. If you have a lab that uses a standardized method for their patient values which is standardized, then you are in the column A. And if your lab uses a method which is based on just an international conventional calibrator which is not traceable, you will be in this column here. And as you move down the column, the metrological traceability comes down and uncertainty of measurement goes higher and higher. So when you don't have very much in here, and that particular analyte that you're measuring falls in here and the manufacturer uses that, your result could be good, but when you compare this to this, there is a quantum shift of results accuracy that you are going to be delivering out to your lab clients, and this is where the big differences are coming in and confusing the physicians and the patients. Now, once we have the standardized material and everything is going fine, there becomes another huge problem of looking at this standard reference material, which is looking at the science in metrology, we call it commutability. And commutability is another big issue that we are facing now with the recent SRMs that have just come out to NIST. Although these materials are very, very good, we need to ensure the commutability that these SRMs are providing is available. Because most of these materials may not be commutable and the sources of non-commutability are in here. Material handling, processing, lyophilization, filtering, they are supplemented and there are differences if sample has been taken from healthy, you know, serum sample of disease or if it's a human-based, fresh serum-based or even human ones if it's lyophilized. So there's a lot of interferences that come in here and this is done by Hubert Wesper from CDC who has very gladly collaborated with us. Now, I was going to show you this. This is a special report. If you want to have a look at the recent ClinCam that has come out, what does actually commutability mean? I'm trying to go back into SRMs to explain to you if a perfect SRM existed, what would be the challenges that it would be subjected to, even if it performed well and had all human-based serum and it had all of the performance characteristics that Dr. Laila just said. Even the reference material does have a specification that Dr. Laila just presented of 0.1 or 0.2% of uncertainty. So we will revisit that slide again, but I would like you to have a look at this. Here in the first slide, it says this reference material is commutable. And what is happening here, for the concept of commutability of results of for reference material, these two things are going on. The results of commutable reference material have the same numeric relationship between two procedures and the reference material. And if it's not commutable, this is what you get. The patient samples of two methods are in here, but the reference material is apart. So this is the science of traceability in metrology, where standard reference materials need to provide their qualification to become an SRM. An SRM is not very easy to make, and this is where you have a lot of trouble, a lot of hard work that it takes years and years to standardize. And I will present a practical slide later on to say people have made brilliant assays, and assays have given them Nobel Prizes, but still they haven't been standardized. It'll come a little later. Now, looking at this slide again, this is what you're having, what commutability looks at. So this is what is happening. Commutability is the last challenge, the last hoop that agencies need to provide with their standard reference material to a standard, so that it would be accepted from then on as an unchallenged reference material. Now, this is something again that's just come on, and I'm not going to dwell too much on this. This is the status of various assays within clinical chemistry or in the laboratory, where we have standardization issues going on. The first column is in here, what we have, what we don't have, and all of these. If you're interested, you can go back onto ClinChem of this month. It is all in here. You can have a look. Now, coming to the vitamin D aspect, and what has been driving us to various problems in the measurement, and why have we had this, and what can be done, is what we will look at. These are some of the slides from our colleagues in U.S. So this is the typical area where you would get some vitamin D from. Another one in here, or somewhere in here with supplementation. So what the problems we've had with this is looking at the various forms and how we started to get in this conundrum we are in. Now, looking at non-standardized assays for vitamin D, where a lot of kids had problems, was looking at the different forms. One of the areas where they're looking at is non-equimolarity. Is they're either looking at this or whatever, and then the result was not a true representation of what's going on. Then we had a lot of discussion coming about this one, 3-epimer of vitamin D. And this again, we're looking at from a metrological perspective, that we need to really understand which forms we're looking at and how are they interfering and how are they becoming a problem. And if we don't understand what we're measuring, and how can we measure them accurately. So this is what is happening in here, and this is the culprit in here, which people have said, these are only babies, these are only neonates. And I will present you a slide where all of this has been proven to be wrong again. It is present in adults, not by one group, by several groups to a very high level. I'm going to present that slide. So that is that. And we have more interferences from isobaric substances as this, and other structural interferences from these compounds. So it's not an easy task, like Dr. Lana just said. It's a complex analyte. It has a lot of interferences. It has a lot of forms. And we have very little understanding until now how many other ones are existing, and what we're measuring is the only thing. So this is where we come to the traceability issue. Are we well defined with the analyte that we would wish to measure? Are we very clear cut about what we are trying to look at? So this is what is the existing conundrum. Now, going back to the latest study that just came out, I would like to point out the big problem that was just highlighted to you in the previous lecture is the binding protein. And looking at the binding protein, this is where when we looked at a lot of kits compared to the LC-MS, these are the issues we had with intensive care patients, dialysis patients, pregnant women, and healthy in comparison. So what The binding protein, again, played a huge big part. And this is, if you would like to look at the current one, this is just this month's ClinCan. And this is one of the most spectacular achievements they have ever looked at in a non-LC-MS-based assays where binding protein has a very well-defined inverse relationship of vitamin D compared to the binding protein. So this is the first time ever it has come out. I will show you more slides on this one. If you look at this, this is again the slide in healthy individuals, the distribution of vitamin D binding protein, pregnant women, dialysis patients, intensive care patients. So this is posing the biggest problem that we always had the challenge in. The old assays like Dr. Hollis did was brilliant, but we wanted more faster tests. We wanted to do higher number, but that test was, instead of taking that, we had to move on. My lab had been doing about 100, 150. Now I do 600 every day. And I have a colleague in Mayo Clinic who does 10 times more in a day. So this is the way in which things are moving, and this is why people have moved on from the classical very good RIA to an automated system. So now you can very well appreciate why the lab is under pressure to go on a high throughput machine instead of a traditional assay or a higher level, higher metrological assay that would give more accuracy. So this is what is happening. We really need to understand this before we move on and change our assays, how things look at. Now this is again a summary of what I had presented. Now, what were the barriers to standardization of 25-hydroxyvitamin D? There was a lack of systematic process to identify and prioritize the measurements, so we've just discussed this. Lack of commutable reference materials, we never had this before, and it's only recently these materials have come out, and they need to prove to us through commutability that they have withstood the time of test, that they are commutable. And then again, lack of systematic procedures to implement and harmonize when there is no reference measurement. These are all of the barriers and hindrances that we face in the lab. Now, with all of these diseases that we looked at, we heard about this morning, as vitamin D being directly implicated, IOM has come in and given a very big report on the dietary reference intake, and which created a huge controversy within the scientific community, clinical community, diagnostic community. Everybody was shaken by this, and everybody wanted to know, what are we doing is right, prove it to us. And in a way, the lab was being asked by them, please look at your assays and ensure that they are standardized. And when we look at standardization, and when we look and see, hey, standardization with vitamin D is in a stage of infancy. And what can we do? So this is where the NIST standards started to take limelight. And this is again the same slide that Dr. Laila had presented. This is courtesy of our friend Graham Carter in Imperial College London. All of them, when you look at altered lab mean, is going up and down and up and down. It's just even LC-MS, if you look at it, it's, compared to the all method mean is up, and this one is here. Mind you, this Roche in here is the older one, first generation. So this is what was happening, and I will present to you the latest one a little later. So they were been discussing all of this in light of NIST trying to provide these standard reference materials. Out of the ones that are of any good to our lab, where it is being used for immunoassays to be standardized would be 972, and within this is the first of the four bottles, which is a human-based serum. The other ones are a little bit need to produce their commutability. 2972 is a high-level one, which is being used by LC-MS laboratories. So these are the ones currently that are in the market that have been benefiting the lab community in measurement of their lab accuracy for their testing going on. Time will say how good they are once the commutability results come out. So it's a big challenge being posed on these SRMs coming out of NIST. Now, based on this, now the other slide was standard reference material, and at the same time NIST was producing standard reference material, and another group by Professor Linda Thienpont was producing a candidate reference method again in here. So they have come to a conclusion. I think you shouldn't be surprised in the next few months or a year's time that officially all companies would be told, this is the reference method, guys, please produce your kits, and everything that you make should be standardized to these two reference methods. So sooner or later this is going to come. So you looked at the problem that IOM created, the reference materials that resulted, and the reference methods that have come in. So this is the roadmap we are moving at the moment, how things are happening as far as standardization goes on vitamin D. Now, looking at the other side, in U.S., like Dr. Arvind just showed a brilliant slide, the U.S. has something called an NHANES study, which looks at population-based analysis of interest. And this is conducted by the National Center for Health Statistics, designed to collect information of health and diet of people in the United States. It's for 5,000, and it's unique that it combines a home interview with health tests that are done in a mobile examination center. This is one of the reference examination surveys that the U.S. has, and this is where most of the vitamin D data in the North American database comes out from, that we look at. And sources of vitamin D information, again, when we look at NHANES, was clinical research studies, randomized controlled trials, and population-based surveillance studies, which again went back on to NHANES. NHANES, again briefly, in the NHANES 1, 2, 3, and all of this, they were looking at, these were the dates and these were the ages of groups of populations they were looking at, and this is what we are looking at in terms of what the public health functions they look at, similar to what Dr. Harwai is doing here in Abu Dhabi. So this is a slide that says vitamin D intake and food and dietary supplements was one of the things they looked at, and why they had to change issues over a period of time. And this is age-wise we are looking at in here, and the distribution in percentiles for supplemented food and with intake. Here is the age. I'll go out of in here. Now, levels of vitamin D in serum. Now, what we're looking at in here is the traditional old IOM report that was looking at the wealth of data we have in RIA, which we should recognize and acknowledge is through this method in here, which should be credited with most of the database that we have in here. And what was going on to change this, we will get to a minute and look at this. Like we just had a look at before, measuring 25 hydroxyvitamin D in serum through RIA was developed in the mid-80s in NHANES 3. The original diastereomer method was there, and once we got into 2000 and 2006, they reformulated diastereomer in RIA. That resulted in change and certain, going down and up. We look and see why it happened and what it was. And this is what we're looking at in serum with the NHANES. LC-MS was started after 2006, was all of the data would be done by LC-MS on NHANES starting 2007 forward. I will not go too much into the classical immunoassay methods. We've just spoken about the issues of performance characteristics and their limitations. And then moving forward, we look at the history of measurement of vitamin D in NHANES. NHANES 3, 88 to 84, this was the gold standard where we looked at DiaSorin and RIA through INKSTAR starting, and then we looked at NHANES 2000-2006, reformulated DiaSorin again, and then after 2006, then we moved on to state of art. What they looked at is this one. Now, the reason being the reformulation changes in DiaSorin RIA kit in the late 90s was happening, and they were shifts in QC pools, and that gave negative and positive results for certain lots. And this is what is happening. This is a slide from CDC. This result, the first change, original RIA to reformulation, resulted in 12% lower biomarker levels. And then again, the reformulated RIA fluctuated over time between 2000 and 2006 periods, 5 to 10% higher results. So although in good faith and in good technology, all of this had moved on, but it created a little bit of changes in data, and even little changes as 10% would add on to the overall value in a population-based study. Now, moving on, then to address the problem, then they went on to LC-MS, and LC-MS is looking at something of this in a precision performance characteristics. We will revisit this in another slide later on, and this is what is being chosen to become, hopefully, the reference method. Now, this is the way we stand at the moment in comparison of data all over the world. It is a mess, it is difficult, it is crisscrossing between North America, Canada, UK, Ireland, Germany, and it is confusing. The reason being, we are not standardized. We are not harmonized, and we don't have standardization. So this is what we are in. And this is where I'm going to show you a typical example of standardization. This is something that is a dream that is coming out of the NIST, hopefully, if we use this. And this is how the traceability of higher order is going to come in to our labs and methods. Now, CDC has just started last year an international vitamin D standardization program. And this is something that I will talk to you about a little bit. And what they're doing in here from US, they want to develop a reference system with established metrological traceability, so the end user test performance is consistent across assays within the city, within the labs, between countries. And this is the participating national surveys that will use this, and hopefully what we are going to have once we go back to this, looking at this, then we come down to something of an order in the system, where things would be freely moving around, and if it is well standardized. And this is what is going to happen. A patient from here going to US, from US coming back here, going to UK, Germany, or this. And hopefully we are going to have something here, SKMC, hopefully starting very soon will be a part of the system. They have agreed to take the lab of Dr. Laila within this system, which is going to start very soon in a few months. So maintaining quality, as we started out, standardization is the key. And if we look at this is what is envisaged at the moment, being the candidate reference method, here, all what we have will be a consistent level of results being provided, and no clashing of patients or physicians or groups or clinical practice guidelines organizers between two of them saying this is high, this is low, this is, you know, it's just not moving what's happening. So this is what we envisage is happening. Right. So what do we do? What do we need to do to ensure continued high quality measurements? use a method anchored to accuracy-based traceability chain as much as possible. You would have people coming in to sell their kits, their assets, their materials, try to ascertain as much as possible, are they traceable, are they standardized, are they harmonized as much as possible. I know everybody cannot have LCMS in every lab, but you can ensure that the kit you're buying is in some way standardized or harmonized to a reference material that is fully available in the scientific market. Establish and follow detailed SOPs, train your staff well in procedures, include internal QC samples, participate in PT programs, and use reference materials whenever they are available on a regular basis. Now, this is the slide that I want to put so that you don't go back home dejected. This is, I don't know if you can know who this lady is. She's the one who got the paper in Nature on plasma insulin in human subjects. This was 59. There you go. And awarded Nobel Prize in here for insulin. And please hold your heart, this still hasn't been standardized, so vitamin D is still the, you know, we have a lot of time more. This is again to say even the certified reference material that the NIST is going to be provided out of their lab need to comply with measurement of uncertainty standards of 0.6% of uncertainty in here. So this is what we're looking at from what Dr. Laila has just given, and this is what the reference method has to produce. And as long as we're coming closer to this, and I'll show you a final slide where we stand now as of the moment of January 2012, this is the CVs on the last column in here, and this is what we are looking at, 10% and less. This is what you get. So there's long ways to go, and this is what we're having at the moment. Now, coming back to the other culprit I was talking to you about is the C3 heptamer. These are the two recent articles that have come out, and they say even the adult population has this heptamer. So better make sure your method is so standardized that this again will not present as a problem. NIST has had a own survey of not very many samples where they looked at using their own NIST sample to the reference method on two of these control samples, groups of patient samples, where this was defined as adequate, and the way the results came out was in here, and inadequate in here, or deficient, it wasn't very many. So they are getting there, looking at some of these criteria of insufficiency, deficiency, and toxicity. So this is what they're looking at. This is what it is. I come back to my old slide of this that provided the lipid standardization and all of the big benefits we've got out of that hopefully will come out of the vitamin D program. Now, what are we doing in here is these are some of the definitions we're looking at from IOM. These are the ones from Endocrine Society. And the lab where I work, we usually use decision limits like Dr. Laila has just said. We're not going to give out, you know, something that we're going to make it on a medical model, but we do consult our physicians who are endocrinologists, who could be diabetologists, who could be cardiologists, who could be oncologists or anybody. They look at their own medical specialty perspectives and tell us what they want for their patients. This is what it is. In general, we are going to look at a medical model to look at. So these are the overall conclusions that we must look at. There are still large discrepancies among current methods. The controversial cutoff for deficient concentrations of vitamin D are still prevalent, QA programs are very helpful for you to understand where you stand. Our lab participates in CAP program, CAP accuracy survey, and the DCAS. And if you want to know more and you're interested, you can look at some of what these big gentlemen have been, gurus have been talking about, vitamin D. You can go on ClinChem in one of the issues of 2011. You will find a question and answer from these experts. Then you can take the message yourself. Now, these are the acknowledgments of all of the people that have helped, and most of them are from NIH and CDC. And I end my talk with a verse from Robert Frost, who was the poet of the United States, and his sonnet that comes out is very relevant to vitamin D. And Robert Frost said, "The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep." Thank you very much. You are not the only one. They are hundreds of people. They've raised the biggest controversy in North America. This is something.
I would just like to see where that number came from, okay? But IOM, they said they were only randomized control trials in the institution. Unless they wanted to scare you. And then they used observational studies to make that statement, which is absolutely.
This range coming out from IOM has created the biggest controversy within the clinical community in the world, where they had recommended these ranges. But when they were asked to clarify their position, they said this is on a population model, not a clinical model. So this is what they said. And they said, for you people in the lab, we encourage you to please go ahead and standardize your assays as much as you can. Thank you very much.